It's Chatter on Books, and if you think this introduction is boring, you try writing the copy. I'm Jamie McIntyre. Here's Tori Clark.
It is so great to have everybody back. And in a little bit, we are going to talk with someone. I'm really interested in talking to this woman, Rebecca Lehman, who has this book, The Beheading Game. And if you had told me that I'd be interested, intrigued by, entranced by yet another book about Anne Boleyn or any one of Henry VIII's wives, I would say, nope, but it's terrific. But in the meantime, Claude's here doing the important work, looking very hip, hanging out at hip places lately, David Aldridge, and our friend Lou Byard. Welcome back, Lou.
Welcome. It's great to be back. I realize I have sort of a Barbara Walters diffusion lens going on here, and I just think it's just a function of where the light is in my office right now, but it'll be fun.
Do you know who else has had a great diffusion lens whole system? Diane, come on, ABC.
Diane Sawyer.
Sawyer.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the great Sybil Shepherd on Moonlighting was well known.
Of course.
She actually made fun of it.
Because the contrast was so jarring between her and Bruce Willis. It's like, what happened? What happened to the light?
It was funny.
Among the many gigs I've had, I did Talking Head stuff for ABC for a long time, or a few years. And I'm in New York doing something stupid. And they're just, it was some stupid something. They're juggling studios and this and that, whatever kind of thing. And they said, okay, throw so-and-so over here. Tori, you go over here. And there was kind of this buzz. It's Diane's set. I wasn't paying any attention to this. And then when they're setting me up for this live shot or whatever it was, I'm thinking to myself, no, it was taped. And I thought to myself, oh, hi, Rebecca. We were just raving about you. I say to myself, I think I've heard that Diane has like supersonic cameras and lenses and everything else. This could be great. Well, then all of a sudden there's chaos because Diane, who was not supposed to be there that morning, was coming into the studio to ABC in New York, and no one else was allowed to use her studio. Do you know that opening scene in The Devil Wears Prada?
Mm-hmm.
Virtual, you know, and everybody's running. That's what it was like.
Everyone's like panicking. Yes.
People were throwing me into
those situations. This studio's for this person. They're coming in.
Yeah.
You guys got to get this thing clear in 15 minutes. And then you're rushing and scrambling.
Yeah. And then I got thrown in some basement studio where they take infomercials or something.
You were in storage B with the guy from Office Space. That was you.
Exactly. Okay. Lou, I know you were doing something important this past weekend, but before we get to that, what you were doing over the weekend, because I'm horribly depressed. I love watching the Olympics. I watch it nonstop. I watch it live. I watch the replays, everything. Favorite moments from the Olympics, if you did indeed watch, Claude, then David, then Lou.
My favorite moments from any Olympics is always the opening ceremony and the closing ceremony. Mm-hmm. I love to see countries that are presenting 4, 6, 7 athletes, and they're happy to be there because, you know, they train for this for their entire lives. They come here. This is their moment. Whether they medal or not, it doesn't even seem like it's important to them. They're happy to be there. Closing ceremonies, they're having a good time, and they're going to go back to, you know, their regular lives. And I just love to see countries that, you know, 3 or 4 athletes, and they're just screaming and yelling in the opening ceremonies. Closing ceremonies that they were just happy to be there. Those are my favorite moments. I couldn't care less about luge or any of that stuff with the winters. I don't care about that stuff.
Mongolia always puts a lot into the costumes, the outfits they wear because that's their moment.
And I love it. And I love it for them. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, David.
It was Alana Myers Taylor winning the mono bob and winning the gold medal in the mono bob. She's 41 years old.
Yeah.
She's got 2 kids who are both hearing it impaired, deaf. It's fantastic. Like, this is what it's all about. I shouldn't assume that. She's raising 2 children. She's trying to be an Olympian. She's in middle age. And she's just rocking it. And it's fantastic. Yeah. Like, that's like, I'm in awe of people who do that.
Yeah.
I just can't believe the amount of dedication it takes to be an Olympic athlete, to be that good at something that you're one of the best in the world.
And to keep coming back.
Exactly.
Keep coming back. Okay, Lou.
Okay. So I loved Alicia Liu. Everything about
great.
Her. Yeah.
She's great.
Fabulous. But here's the thing. I always get really stressed during the skating because I'm whenever they fall or bobble, I get very stressed. So I love the exhibition that comes at the end of the games. because then they're not worried about medals, and they can skate. And Ilya did a beautiful skate, and Alicia, of course, a beautiful skate. I says, I can just watch you do what you do without the pressure and the terror of falling on the ice and not
Yeah.
meddling. Yeah, so
But
I love the exhibition skate. Yeah.
that was so great about her gold medal performance. And I hate to pick
Yeah.
a gold medal performance as the one, my
Yeah.
favorite moment, but that was so great about it. She was one of, if not the only one we saw on television who was happy to be there. The rest
Right?
of them just tortured. That poor little Russian girl who was like 4 foot nothing, 75 pounds. I mean, her life is over because she didn't do so well,
You
but
couldn't even
she
drag
knew
me
it.
on the ice. That you couldn't even
Yeah.
drag me out onto the ice for that. That is just so
Yeah.
much pressure. Yeah.
Yeah, and Lisa Lu just seemed to have a great time.
Oh, she did.
So that really was my favorite. And then I could not stop obsessing about her. And Gu, Eileen Gu.
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
Yeah.
first of all, beautiful,
Yes.
extraordinarily talented. I think she's pre-med at Stanford, something like that. And seems like a perfectly normal person. That cannot be.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Which is hard at,
Yeah.
and I don't mean that in a bad way. Well, you're an Olympic, when you're Olympic level, you are obsessed about whatever it is you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then pre-med on top of that. It's like, oh my
Right.
God. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Does something
Tori,
about pre-med.
if I could ask David, like all
Sure.
the sports that you cover, I mean, these are the best at what they do, whether it's basketball, football, tennis, anything.
Yeah.
Is it the same with the Olympic athletes? I mean, these are the best at
Oh,
what they
yeah.
do. Is there something that's just a little bit like, if this person's like pretty normal, that's a huge deal.
I mean, they're normal in some ways because their sports, don't get the attention like monobob.
Yeah.
Nobody pays attention to monobob, so you can be a normal person. Whereas if you're playing soccer or you're playing basketball or one of the sports or running track and everybody knows who you are, it's different. But yeah, no, a lot of Olympians, I love talking. I remember doing a wrestling match in, oh God, which Olympics was that? Was it London? And it was phenomenal because these two guys were just in the middle of the ring, and it was like 1-0 or 2-1, and they're just like dying with every move. And it was just so, and the one guy won, and the other guy lost, and he couldn't believe he lost, and he just was just sobbing in the middle of the mat, just sobbing. And he's a big 280-pound guy, and he's just sobbing. Like it's just,
Yeah.
right.
It's another reason I loved
It's
Alyssa
unbelievable.
Liu. After
Yeah.
when they did the team competition, she was always ch cheering for everybody else in the team and high five them, everything else.
Yeah.
And then when it came even to the individual performance, she sat and she's hugging the other performers, the other skaters, and she's making them feel good about what they did. Not their coaches. Again, that poor Russian girl.
Oh,
Never
I
gonna hear
know.
from her. Never gonna hear from her again. Ever.
Log
That's right.
time. There's a gulag waiting for
Exactly.
those guys.
Where all the little skaters go.
Yeah.
Okay. From a wonderful couple of weeks, hockey, great, wonderful. Lou, tell us where you were on Saturday and what was it like?
Well, I was at a wake, in effect. I was at a
Yeah.
wake last Saturday for Washington Post Book World, which was shuttered by the current Bezos regime after being around since 1972 in one form or another.
Wow.
So this was a sad day for someone like me who's been writing. I've been writing for them for 30 years, but also for people like Ron Charles and Michael Gerda and these marvelous weekly book reviewers who've been like holding readers' hands and
Yeah.
guiding them toward really good stuff. And also just a sad day for literary culture because, it didn't have to happen. It didn't have to happen. So,
Yeah.
but we
What would
gathered
you?
there. But the encouraging part was we gathered there for this wake, and I've never seen politics and prose so packed with people upstairs, down.
Nice.
It was wall to wall people, mourners. But yeah, but there
Yeah.
to say, hey, we like what you guys did, and we respect it, and we love books, and so that's
Yeah.
the encouraging thing note I take away with me.
Yeah, and I've traded a few emails and texts with Ron Charles, who's just fantastic. Absolutely great guy. And by the way, if anybody does Substack, do that.
Substack for sure. Yeah.
He's on there. He's
Yeah.
already producing really good, wonderful stuff. He's done a little reflection on what happened, but yeah, he's done more for, I think, books than, not than Oprah. Oprah's done more than anybody else, but he's
Right.
done a lot, and we
But
want more.
I think that could be a very, very, very smart thing for somebody to do here in DC, which is to get some of those ex-posties together and start some sort, whether it's
Yeah.
Substack or something about centered on books. And I think
Yeah.
go through the roof with subscribers. I think this what city is more into reading than
Right?
Washington? You know what I mean? Like, it's just
More PhDs per capita than any place in
yeah,
the
I mean, it's
and
just
David, they
like,
took away the sports section too,
of
which
course,
pissed me off
yes, they
in the
did.
local news and that
Yeah, they did. They did.
Yeah, David couldn't cover my antics the other night at the basketball game because there's no
I
more coverage
know.
of local
Lou,
fights.
she almost got taken in. She's about to get in a fight with a dookie. I love
I
it.
would have
Would
won.
have been
If
there.
it had
You would have won.
escalated, I would
You
have
would have
won.
won. Because I think
No, no.
you throw a sneaky hook. I bet you do. I bet you do. When you
Exactly.
get your weight behind it,
Yeah, I'm bigger than that.
She's from Pittsburgh. She can hold her own.
Indeed, indeed.
Exactly.
Pittsburgh,
Lou,
indeed.
do you remember the first thing you wrote for the Post for Bookworld?
Yes, it was a review of Rita Mae Brown's memoir, which was called, this is 1996 we're talking about. It was called Rita Will. And when they
Wow.
asked me to do it, my response was Lou will as well. Lou will
Do you
also
remember what
do
they paid you back
that.
then?
Oh, for gosh sakes. God, not it wasn't it was never about the money, Tori, as you
Of
know. It
course
was
not.
never
Of course
about
not.
yeah. So
Submission.
I think probably $300 or something like that. Yeah.
That's
And
not
yeah.
bad. Not
You don't write book reviews to make money. That is for damn sure. But
bad. You
it
write
was a
them to make.
wonderful, and I had wonderful editors, and it was a lovely 30-year run. And I
And you only
missed
made a few enemies in the process.
just a couple, just a couple. Not too many. Not too
Okay,
many.
before we go to our wonderful author, Rebecca Lehman, of this evening, what are you working on, Lou, that you can tell us about?
I can't tell you much except I'm trying to get another a book off the ground in these difficult times. So,
If
but I
anybody
just.
replaced poker with Lou, if you can't see him on News Channel 8, his tell is this little scratch behind the ear.
Oh, the scratch around the ear. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Like
But
eating, it's like
don't
when
know whether, I don't know how much that tells you, honestly, just that I'm comfortable talking
nothing.
about the next book. So, yeah. But
Animal,
Like
mineral,
Kitty Cake
I'm
Three
going to
is
ask
the
Rebecca how she feels
Oreo
about
and
the question when
Rounders,
she
like
gets
the.
on, how she feels about the next work question.
Oh, they hate it. That's why it's always in there. Okay.
Exactly.
Rebecca, welcome to Chatter on Books. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for being with us and for your patience.
Hi, thank you for having me. That was a fascinating conversation to come into. Sounds
Because
like
you
you all
wanted to
are.
hear about the Olympics and sports and
It did make me feel really sheepish because I will admit I have not watched a second of the Olympics this
No,
year.
not at all.
Well, I have two young kids, and so, the
Oh,
evenings are just
how old?
really full.
What
Seven
ages?
and 11.
And they weren't
Yeah.
interested at all?
No, they're not really very sporty. I mean, they play sports at school, gym class, whatnot, but
Sure. Wow, that's
yeah.
how my parent management with my parents' mother and father of five girls was just turn the TV on during the Olympics, and we don't have to talk to our
Yeah.
children for 2 weeks.
Okay. Yes, but now everything is streaming. So it's not like there's no
Right,
TV to turn
right,
on. Like, we don't have
right.
cable, there's no network. We don't, we don't have an antenna. I don't know.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, would you like to watch a show? And the whole of Netflix, Hulu, et cetera, is available to them, Disney
Exactly.
Plus, and they're not going to choose the Olympics. They're going to choose like a baking reality TV show. So that's what I've been watching the last 2 weeks.
Great. Okay, Rebecca, I've told several people when I was talking about doing the show tonight. I think Josie sent months ago. Josie, your wonderful publicist sent me
Yes,
something
she's
months ago.
wonderful.
And right away, like I saw Anne Boleyn, I was like, please. I said, I'm like the best amateur, Henry VIII, every six wives, saw the musical 16 times, everything. Like, no, who could write
Wonderful.
anything about Anne Boleyn that would be remotely interesting? I could not put The Beheading Game down.
Oh, thank
I had
you.
we had a couple other podcasts coming up, and I hadn't read those books, and I just kept reading it. But I want to do a little bit on your backstory. Poetry is kind of your first claim to fame, right?
Yeah, that's right. I've been a poet for the last 20 years or so. I
Why
did
do you
an
laugh when you say
MFA.
that?
Well, it just has such like a hard, it's such a hard, I feel like I took a hard right turn into or left turn into fiction. I did an MFA in poetry. I've published three books of poetry. I love it. My heart is still there. But I wanted to try writing a novel, and so The Beheading Game.
You did Iowa Writers' Workshop, right?
I did, yes. I have an MFA from there in
Yeah.
poetry.
We've
Yeah.
had a few authors on from there, and we had the executive director on once with that great book about the, it was like the Chinese restaurant of succession. Fantastic.
Yeah. Yes.
So if you're doing poetry at the Iowa Writers'
Yes.
Workshop, Lou, did you ever have dreams of doing the Iowa Writers' Workshop?
I did, but I did not dream of applying. You know, I'm one of those bums who doesn't have an MFA in anything.
Yeah, well, you're doing okay.
That's okay.
So, Rebecca, do the people who are studying poetry there, do you mix and mingle? Hold on, sorry. Do you mix and mingle with the other people?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's not a small program. Some MFA programs are like three people in each genre.
Yeah.
When I was there, I think it was like 20 people per genre per year. And absolutely, the poets and the fiction writers hang out. And I have some good friends from that time that are fiction writers, which I was glad to have when I decided to write a novel and needed advice on things like, how do you get an agent? And what do you put in a query letter? And then what happens after that? Those sorts of practical things. But they don't let you take workshops in the other genre, or they didn't when I was there. So if you come in poetry, you can only take poetry classes. Uh-huh. And if you come in fiction, you can only take fiction classes.
That seems a little restrictive, but okay.
It is what it is.
Yeah. Okay, so what caused you to make this hard left turn, I guess, to fiction?
Yeah, well, you know, I had been thinking about for years, I had been writing down ideas for novels in notebooks, in the notes app on my phone, and I was just always so busy. You know, like I got a graduate degree, I went and got a PhD, I became an academic, I had kids almost right after getting a tenure track job. There just was not a lot of time. And poetry is something that you can squeeze into small corners of your life and still do pretty successfully. And I was so intimidated by the process of writing a novel and worried that if I started it, I wouldn't have time to finish. And what if I didn't do a good job, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then I turned 40 and had a little baby midlife crisis. And I thought, if I don't do it, I'm never going to do it. And I had this idea kicking around for a novel about Anne Boleyn, where, like, what if she came back to life after her beheading, sewed her head back on, and tried to kill Henry VIII? And I thought, I'm just going to sit down and start writing, and we'll see what happens. And if I can finish the book, it'll be a big accomplishment, and we'll go from there. And then I did finish it, and I felt like it was pretty good. And so we went from there.
Crazy, crazy idea. Again, because it's one of the, Henry VIII, the Six Wives, it's one of the most heavily covered, heavily written about. Lou, if, say it's, you know, 5 years ago, and your book world calls you up from Washington Post, Godspeed, and said, want you to review this book about Anne, what would your initial, your gut reaction have been?
Well, once I see the premise about her snatching up her own head, I think, okay, that's a little different. That is magical realism. That's something... That's we're going off the usual highway of Anne Boleyn. But what I'm fascinated by, and I'd love Rebecca to comment, is Anne Boleyn is still such a badass. She should be a victim the way we look at her, but we continue to look at her as kind of a badass. I mean, I'm just fascinated by that. She's not a martyr. She's tough. And
yeah.
She's strong. Yeah.
I agree. I mean, I think part of why I wanted to write this novel is because I feel like often Anne Boleyn is portrayed in like a kind of two-dimensional light as this like oversexed homewrecker who gets what she deserves when she's executed. But I will agree with you, she is often, even in that light, presented as a little bit of a badass. Like, she's a really vocal person. She was known to pick fights. She had a really hot temper. And I don't think any of that gets dulled down in historical representations, even when she's being presented in kind of a two-dimensional light. I mean, one of the things that I hope to do in the novel, though, was to show her in a more complex way and to like really dive into how she was very intelligent, how she was like a true believer in the Protestant Reformation, how she was probably innocent of all the charges laid against her, and to just kind of get into the mindset of like, if you have a kind of fiery hot temperament of Anne Boleyn and you're wrongly accused and then you're executed and then you could somehow come back into consciousness after that. And up until like the last minute, she thought that she was going to be saved by Henry VIII. She thought that he would like come and commute her sentence or whatever. But what would it be like to wake up and have to go back through and dig back through all of that and try to figure out what went wrong? Like, how did you end up there? You know,
it seemed like it was very current as well. I'm the least literary person on this podcast. But I just thought it had these really interesting questions and issues about power and women's role in society. Did that factor into your writing at all? Did you, I mean, tell us about the process, the construct.
Yeah,
did
I mean,
that factor in as well? Did you address her as a woman from the 16th century, or did you think of her as a woman maybe in the 21st century?
I think that I did want to be really mindful of like keeping the time period of the 16th century accurate. But I also think that she was a woman ahead of her time. And I think that then, as is the case now, women are sometimes punished when they end up in powerful positions. And I really wanted to explore that idea in the novel and think about ways that, like, this extremely intelligent and powerful woman was set up to kind of like co-lead with Henry VIII. Like, he crowned her, he had her coronated with this crown that was usually reserved for just people that were born into royalty, not for people that married into it. So it really seemed like he was setting her up to co-lead England with him. And then she just kind of like got too bright. Like, I think she just shone too brightly and threatened other people in the court. And then there was this sort of like coordinated movement led partly by Thomas Cromwell, but also partly by her own husband, who I think found her very threatening at a certain point. Like, what he was attracted to in her, this intelligence and this fierceness, became what he ultimately feared in her, but he had absolute power to have her executed. And so then that's what he did. And I think that, you know, fortunately, at least, you know, like, there's not, people aren't being, women aren't being executed for being too powerful right now in America. But I do think that there is, you know, we still see stories like that now of women that shine too brightly, get too powerful. You know, we haven't yet elected a woman president, for example.
Yeah. Don't know what to do with their laughs, right? That's for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Speaking of Cromwell, I assume you read Wolf Hall?
Oh my gosh, yes. During the pandemic, I read the Wolf Hall books, and in fact, that was a big part of where my thinking about this book came from, because they were just a lifeline to me when I was like cooped up with my kids and felt like I was climbing the walls. To be able to escape into those books and to just see like how Hilary Mantel could create Thomas Cromwell, who's a pretty like despicable character in a lot of lights, but she made him so sympathetic. I cried at the end of the third book when he was executed. No, I hope I'm not giving away the ending there. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
If she had had, you know, two or three male offspring that survived, would Henry have allowed her to continue to be that
strong?
Oh,
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in 1536, which is the year that Anne Boleyn is executed, she's executed in May. And in January of that year, she was pregnant and had a miscarriage and miscarried a baby far enough along that they could tell that the baby was a boy. Wow. And I think, and a lot of historians think as well, that that was part of what led to her execution, that she had had one living child, Elizabeth, who went on to be Queen Elizabeth I, like one of the greatest monarchs of England. Yeah. But then she had a series of miscarriages, anywhere from 2 to 4. Nobody knows completely, like nobody can know for certain. And that the last one was a boy, I think certainly damned her. I think if she'd been able to give birth to a live boy in the 3 years that she was married to Henry, which is very little time to have had like a, to have had a full term pregnancy and 2 to 4 miscarriages in that time. I mean, I can't even imagine, but if she'd been able to give birth to a boy, she probably would have had a different fate. Yeah.
Did you 100%. Compare and contrast her to the other wives? Divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived, by the way, for those who are trying to.
Yeah. Yes, I did. I found that rhyme very helpful as an American writing this book. Because I didn't learn about all that stuff in history class. But I did. I tried to keep the comparisons to the wife that preceded her, Catherine of Aragon, and the wife that followed her, Jane Seymour. And I will say, like, I have great sympathy for all six of those women. I think people tend to really like pick favorites with the wives of Henry VIII, but they were all victims and they all suffered. But I did really try to think about what would Anne Boleyn have thought of Catherine of Aragon. And I think she would have thought that she was incestuously married to Henry VIII, because that was the argument he used to divorce her, that she had previously been married to his brother. And so they shouldn't have ever been able to get married, because that's incest. And then I think she also would have really hated Jane Seymour, because Jane Seymour was her lady in waiting and was having like basically a chaste affair with Henry VIII before Henry had Anne Boleyn executed. And so I think she would have had deep resentment to both of those women. But I also wanted in the novel to have her kind of thinking through how she felt about both of those women, and also thinking through how patriarchal societies encourage women to compete with each other and to dislike each other and to form rivalries. And that's something that she's kind of grappling with as the novel goes forward.
I thought that was one of the things that made it seem so current to me. You know, and there's an expression that lots of women like to throw around, especially in places like Washington, like there's a special place in hell for women who don't help other women. Most of the time they don't. Let me just share that with you.
I mean, women are also people. Like, we're not under an obligation to just be like endlessly selfless with other people. Though, right, in contemporary feminist context, you'd like to think women are helping each other, but sure.
I always think about Anne Boleyn's sister, who was kind of the warm-up act. Like, wow. And Anne took lessons from her. Like, oh, no. I used to make there. Is it true with their court? She would not allow Henry to, go to fourth, home run, sexually speaking, for 7 years. Is that true?
7 years. They courted for 7 years.
Crazy.
But if they had had sex and consummated the relationship before they were married, and she were to get pregnant, then the offspring would be illegitimate. So, like, she strung him along,
She knew.
saying she well, and in fact, because Mary had already like had an affair with him, like that, that was kind of part of her promise. Like, look how fertile my sister is. I'll give you a boy. Look at my sister Mary. Look at what
Like
she's able
Hamilton.
to do.
Like the Schuyler sisters.
Oh my gosh, right? I love
We
that musical, but I do wish there were some women in it that didn't sleep with Hamilton.
The commercial for Six the Musical, which I think is a touring company now, whatever, it is really fun, really great to see. I
The
took a bunch of
sunshine.
20-something young women to that last time it was in Washington, and they all kind of looking at me going, we never knew this. They learned something, which was so great. Plus, it was really fun. Okay, Rebecca, what did you learn? What surprised you as you were doing the research, as you were doing the writing, as you were making this wonderful book happen? The Beheading Game. I don't say that often enough.
Yeah.
It's a
Learn.
great title. It's an
It's a
amazing
great title.
Thank you. Well, okay, so it's a book that's really like it's really out there, right? There's this huge magical realism element of her coming back to life, and there's a couple of other like magical realism elements as the book goes forward. But I really, as I was writing the novel, like initially I just kind of envisioned this as being like she's going to try to get to Henry as fast as possible. She's going to meet some interesting people along the way. And then I had her meet this character named Alice, who is a part-time sex worker in London, and from like a low-class commoner background. And she's from like a part of England that people really look down on called the Fens, that was kind of like a swamp in the north of London. And I got so infatuated with her character. And then that ended up kind of blossoming into a little mini love story for Anne as the book goes forward. And I really enjoyed learning about life for common people in London, Tudor London, during this time, and writing from the perspective of a common person, which I think, like, obviously, both of these characters are pretty far from my lived experience, but I'm from a working class background myself. I'm like as far from being on the throne of a country as you can get. And so I really enjoyed diving into this character who had a different perspective and who could really call Anne Boleyn on some of her elitist bullshit as the novel went forward, like, and say, like, I know you think that like you are the bee's knees or whatever, but everything you have is pried off of the backs of working people. And so that was a really interesting avenue to go down. I also really enjoyed learning more about Anne's relationship with her daughter. Like, part of royal life at this time is that children were taken away from their parents at a really young age and given their own household. So Elizabeth is taken away at like 3 months old, but Anne is so interested in her. And one of the last things that she did in the Tower of London before her trial was order clothing for her daughter for like the upcoming summer and fall season, because she was so concerned with making sure that she had appropriate clothing. And I just recognized in that move, like, things that I do for my own kids, the amount of time, especially when my kids were a little bit younger, that I spent thinking about, will they have the right clothes for summer? Will they have the right clothes for fall? What size do they need? What kind of a dress will she need for Christmas? Those sorts of questions that just really seem inherent to mothering. And it was interesting to see Anne from that perspective, because I think that she's just often presented as this queen figure, and almost like her daughter Elizabeth, who is this huge historical figure, is this sort of like footnote in her life. But I think that although she wasn't allowed to be with her constantly, she was always on her mind.
I think that might have been the most surprising things. I'm sorry, Lou, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, were there particular sources that you depended on that you found particularly useful for exploring this period?
Yeah, I read so many historical texts by historians, Tracy Borman, Natalie Gruniga, Owen Emerson. There's a whole group of historians in the UK that are working on Anne Boleyn and doing really interesting and groundbreaking work. And then I went, after I'd written the first draft of the novel, I went to London and did a research trip and visited a lot of the places in the novel. So I spent an inordinate amount of time at the Tower of London, taking notes, taking pictures of every placard. I went to Hever Castle, Anne's childhood home, and got to see some really interesting exhibits there, including the prayer book that's mentioned in the book that she gets from Henry as a present that he gave, like the identical present to Anne Boleyn, Catherine of Aragon, and Thomas Cromwell for the same New Year's. Like he just triplicated the gift, which I thought was kind of a sociopathic thing to do. Yeah.
But did you find anything redeeming about Henry VIII? In your research?
I was going to ask that too.
Or is he just kind of a D-bag?
He's such an interesting figure. Yeah, he is. He becomes such a monster. I think he's a real Bluebeard figure. And he's easy to hate because he is really abusive to all of his wives. And he's just so single-mindedly in pursuit of his son. But I will say, like, a little bit of sympathy that I have for him is that he was also kind of confined by his position in life. And he had watched his older brother die before him, who was supposed to be the king. He was the spare, not the heir. And I think he had a lot of anxiety about making sure that he could peacefully pass down the throne, because his father had come to power at the tail end of the giant civil war, the War of the Roses. And so, like, that anxiety was not misplaced. From a contemporary viewpoint, he just seems like a monster of a person. But if your whole life, everybody has told you that you've been like ordained by God to rule the country, and then your second wife is like, what if you also took over the church? Then you have even more power. I mean, I can absolutely see how that would go to a person's head. I still don't really like him, but I could see what would make him the way that he was.
Just a beast, though. Just a beast.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, as he aged too, right before the same year that Anne Boleyn is executed in January of that year, also the same month that she has her miscarriage, he falls in a jousting accident and injures his leg really badly. And then he gets this really gross wound that won't heal. It stunk so bad that it was said that you could smell it from like the next room over, and it just festered for the rest of his life. And he got very large and portly after that too, because he couldn't like move around anymore. So I think in addition to being monstrous in his actions, he grew kind of like monstrous in appearance as he aged too.
So he was attractive before that, right?
He was absolutely. Yeah. And that was something I really tried to get across in the novel as well. Like when Anne Boleyn met him, he was a catch. He was like in his 30s and very athletic. And when he became king in his late teens, he was like intelligent, smart, charismatic, good looking.
Kind of well read, right? Studied a lot.
Yeah. He was a big reader. Yeah, I can see why he would have been attractive, but I think, you know, as they say, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, and probably the power just got to him. Yeah. Or maybe there was something wrong with him to begin with. I don't know.
Next book.
Yeah, perhaps.
Because
next book is Anne of Cleves, who's the one who sort of got away.
Sort of.
But she got a divorce. She kept her head.
Keeping the head. Again, people, see the musical Six if you can. It's very fun, very funny, historically accurate, and just great music. Absolutely great music.
Yeah, it's so catchy.
Yeah, it's fabulous. Okay, the book is The Beheading Game. It's really fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. And Rick, I have to tell you, when did I sign you up for tonight? A couple months ago, right?
Yeah.
I sent Lou the podcast we have lined up for the first few months of this year, and we've got some really good ones. And I said, take your pick. When do you want to show up? And he picked yours.
Said Anne Boleyn snatches up her own head. Of course I'm going to go for that. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Great. Hey, Chatterheads. It's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. So download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, you know, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
Really, really appreciate, Rebecca, you joining us. Really love the book, The Beheading Game. Just fabulous.
Thank you so much.
It's a topic that's been covered pretty heavily, but it's just such a unique way of looking at her. And again, I don't know the right words, but it's just so current, so incredibly current. So we really encourage everybody, go to your favorite independent bookstores and buy The Beheading Game. We are back in 2 weeks with Mark Hertling, who, wonderful guy. Very different from this week. Retired general, just incredible guy. And he's the author of If I Don't Return, A Father's Wartime Journal. It's really, really something. He's a very cool Renaissance guy. It's a wonderful book. But in the meantime, Claude, David, Lou, thank you so much, my friends. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you in a couple weeks. And we're out.